Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio. We are continuing our Iditarod Musher series here this evening. And tonight we have Ramey Smith on the line calling in from, I believe, the side of the road in his truck. Ramey, are you there?
Yes. Yep. I'm there. I just got done working on a log house and pulling a big piece of equipment back home.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this evening. I know that we've lined this up in the last couple of weeks, and a lot of people are excited to have you on. So everybody knows who you are in the Iditarod, but for our new fans, tell us about yourself and what you're all about.
Well, first I'd like to thank my main sponsors, ACS, Alaska Communication Systems, and First Tool Corp., and a good friend of mine, Steve Rip, and of course my wife, Rebecca Moore, for helping keep this racing kennel going. And I've been mushing for over 30 years and been in a mushing family that's been in it for pushing 70, maybe 100. And we love to train dogs and to take care of them. And my favorite thing to do is basically just feed lots of happy huskies.
Well, I know that you live right there in the Willow, Houston area. Have you lived in this part of the country your entire life, or where do you hail from?
Well, I was originally born in Tanana, and I've been raised everywhere from up in Fairbanks to on the villages to Glen Allen, but mostly in the last 20 years or so I've spent down in this area. My dad had a agricultural parcel, so we've spend a lot of time raising hay and raising dogs and horses.
Well, you know, it's arguably one of the better places in Alaska to mush dogs, right there off of the Parks Highway. Can you introduce our mushing fans to what happens around Willow? I don't think we've had on a Willow musher yet. I apologize. We did have on Dee Dee, but at least on that side of the highway where you're at, tell us a little bit about what goes on over there where you're mushing in terms of trails and training and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, we're in a pretty good spot there at the base of Hatcher's Pass. You know, we use the Gold Bullion Trail there to train on. I have to share it with a lot of snow machiners and skiers and such. But we're right where the snow belt starts to start. So it's a little challenging. We get a lot of rain and such. So a lot of the times I have to go up towards Cantwell to do training.
Well, first off, congratulations on your third place finish. I definitely want to get into that here a little later on in the show. I know you put on one heck of a race there this year in this year's Iditarod, so I definitely want to get into that. But tell us a little bit about your roots. I know that that you ran the junior Iditarod when you were a youngster and won twice, and as your bio says on Iditarod.com, you've pretty much grown up with mushing since you were born. So how in the world have you held on for this long? You said you've been involved for 30 years. That's a heck of a pedigree there.
Well, you know, it's just been in my blood, and I love to take care of dogs, and I think that's basically what it is. That's why I've been in the sport for so long. You know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to race, and like when I did a rod, my mom was into the first few I did a rods, one of the first women to run I did a rod. A lot of people probably know her, Lolly Medley, and of course Bud Smith is my dad, and he ran the first I did a rod and was instrumental with Joe Reddington in helping getting the first one started. And so, you know, this has just been the life of Smith, I guess.
So with your dad running in that first Iditarod, what have you seen develop over the last, 30-plus years in terms of how the race has changed? Of course, you know, it's a lot of the same trail and things, but how have you seen it evolve, at least from a family perspective?
Well, you know, what's shocking there is that if it was a good dog back when my dad was doing it, it's the same basic good dog is doing it now. And the more closely to the best ones you can go to, the back then are the ones that are really putting on a performance now. When you do the really long runs, you got to have a really tough, happy dog. And so that hasn't changed as much as you would think it has. Lots of people went to breeding in a lot of hound blood, and that didn't turn out as successful as was necessary, I guess. So people are kind of going back to the huskies. And, you know, so you got to have plenty of fur, just like you did back in the early days. And but the biggest thing, I guess, would be the race that's changed. You know, you still need the exact same dog, basically, a good, fast, trotting, hard-working, happy dog. But in the early days, you know, you'd be out there 20 days, and so you'd have to have a very conservative approach. And now it's over in 9-10 days, and so you've really got to get after it right from the beginning. And, you know, everything's probably a little more scientific now and easier. They used to have to change booties about every 20 to 40 miles. Now most of the time we have booties that go, you know, anywhere from 60 to 100 miles, and that saves you a lot of time. No longer do they have to build campfires at every rest stop every 4 hours. Now they can use an alcohol cooker. So for the musher, it's probably an incredible amount easier than it used to be, but it's still an incredibly challenging race because you make it as hard as you want. You try as hard as you want, and so basically it could be as hard for you as you let it be.
How has the musher changed over the last 30 years? Of course, the gear has gotten much better. You see all those videos from the 80s. It looks like they're wearing coats that you could buy at Walmart these days. But, of course, nowadays everybody's wearing, you know, the fancy parkas with the big fur ruffs and that sort of stuff. How do you think the musher and the gear has changed for the human side anyway?
Well, first I did a rod, my mom finished. She finished carrying a flashlight. You know, everybody's got these big fancy LED things that cost $1,000 practically just to light up the trail and go down the trail. You know, one I'm using is probably, you know, worth $100. But in the early days, you know, probably $5 to $10, you get you a flashlight and you take your chances and go, I guess. And now it's like everyone seems to have a lot of money to spend just to get geared up. You know, they used to use down, and I still think that's the best way to go. And, you know, but, yeah, you're right. There's lots more corporate sponsors now and more money involved. In the early days, the people just didn't have a whole lot of money to spend on it. They scraped together everything they could, get some meat scraps from the butcher, and maybe somebody donated some sipping rolls, and away they go.
Right. So speaking of that, with the meat scraps and all, do you think that that nutrition for dogs has changed quite a bit since those early days when you were just a youngster?
Absolutely. You know, they've changed a lot. I would say the commercial dog foods have gotten much better, but my opinion is that meats are still the primary best way to go. You know, dogs are carnivore, and they used to, in the early days, they'd feed a lot of beaver and beef and chicken and stuff, and that's still the best way to go. Back in the early 1800s and 1900s, they're feeding pretty much the same stuff we do, big hamburger balls and lamb and stuff like that, and chicken, and that's pretty much the best way to go now. There for a few years, everybody went heavy to the commercial, and I think that wasn't a really good change, and now everything's going back the other way a bit, back to quality meats.
So let's talk a little bit about your dogs. We're talking to Ramey Smith tonight on Mushing Radio, third place finish in 2012 Iditarod. I believe you have a relatively small kennel in regards to what a lot of guys have. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on over at your place.
Yeah, you know, we usually keep about 30 dogs in that range. I like to have puppies every year, but I haven't had any pups for about probably 4 or 5 years. So it's a pretty small kennel. Our dogs tend to stay in the team for a long time. You know, we'll be racing 10, 11-year-old dogs sometimes. And I think the reason you can do that is you have lots of really good nutrition and careful training, and they have really good attitudes. And so they just don't want to retire. They're like the old guy that you can't get off the job. You know, you just want to keep working every day. And that, you know, when having those good attitudes helps us keep a small kennel. And so, you know, we focus on nutrition and hardcore personal care of each dog, and that way we can keep a really small group and compete with people that have 100 or 200 dogs in their outfit.
When you say we, is it just you? Is it you and your wife? Do you have handlers? How is the kennel set up?
Well, you know, I'd say it's probably 50 60% me and 50% my wife and my daughter that, you know, do the work. We haven't had any handlers for a few years. Occasionally we get a friend to come over and help if we leave or something. But, yeah, we haven't been able to utilize handlers recently. So, yeah, my wife takes a huge part. You know, she's run the quest a few years ago and finished that. People playing at that and harder. And so you can say that she's maybe even the tougher of the two. I don't know. And my daughter, she's always feeding dogs and scooping after them. She's like five now, and she's talk about being into it. She's out there. And then Banyan, you know, he's just getting into feeding them. So he's a year and a half.
he's already out there feeding them at a year and a half, huh?
Oh, yeah. He screams and yells if you don't fill up his pan that he gives each dog.
So you're starting that that third generation of Smiths out there already. Pretty soon they'll be training up to run that junior Iditarod before too long.
I would definitely say the case.
Very cool. So before we start talking about Iditarod, I have to mention your business, Smith Log Works. You're right there off. You do a lot of work right there off the Parks Highway before you head over the hill. Tell us a little bit about that. What's going on with that? You built some awesome stuff. I saw that home you built there off of Twitty Road that you lived in a couple of years back. So tell us about that skill that you have.
Yeah. You know, I've been building log homes or involved in it for 30 years, and but professionally here in the last 6-8 years, we've really got the business going. We're there at mile 67.3, and I like to build scribe-fit log homes. You know, I specialize in quality, and I can pretty much, if you have anything that needs repaired or felt, I can build it if it has to do with wood.
So how long does it take from the time somebody comes up and says, hey, Ramey, I'm interested in you building a house for me, till the time they're ready to move in?
Well, that really depends on how much of a hurry they're in. Most people, it takes about 6 months to a year. You can't really do it for any less than about 4 months. And, you know, it's a long-term process with a log house. You've got to, it's all about quality, and so it usually takes about six months to a year.
You know, we always talk about what folks are doing in their, you know, in the off season here on the show, especially you Iditarod guys. A lot of you guys do school tours and, you know, that sort of thing, and do the, you know, the corporate gig. But you're out there, you know, busting your butt building these houses. Awesome stuff. I have to commend you on that. You do some great work. If you can, again, let's talk a little bit more about that business. The reason why somebody would want to go into that traditional log home versus, you know, your regular old built stick home, I guess they would call it.
Well, a log home has a lot of aesthetic value and has massive historical value. And in Scandinavia, the log homes are lasting 1,000 years as versus the stick homes, you know, last maybe 100 years before they rot away. And so it's a much, much longer term housing, and now I mean 800 to 1,000 years is pretty extreme, and you have much more resale value. And you know, dreamers always want a beautiful log house on a lake, and you know, that dream stays alive for a very long time at 800 to 1,000 years. So I think that's why a lot of people like to go that way. You know, for me, I just like I guess the romance of getting to build a log house.
It's like building a set of Lincoln Logs, 100 scale, I guess.
Yeah, I would say it's hand fit and hand scribed, so it goes a long ways past a Lincoln Log. Lincoln Log would be kind of like a milled log, you know, it'd be kind of boring, but the hand scribed fit log, each log has character that I try to bring out, and various, if it's got a knot somewhere, I try to make it stand out. And so anyway, it's all about bringing out the character of the individual log.
So you do everything from one-room cabins to multi-bedroom homes there, I guess.
Yeah, we've done up to 5,000 square feet homes, and then down to, you know, 600-800 square feet. Right now, we're talking to someone who's looking at maybe building in like a 10,000 square foot house. But I don't know if that'll come through or not, but they're thinking about it.
Holy cow, that's a heck of a lot of work. So I assume that is primarily a summer-type job. When do you start training? When is the preparations for the next Iditarod going on outside of the basic maintenance, you know, the feeding and the daily care? When does training start for you guys over at your kennel?
Well, right now they're on vacation. You know, they're healing up from the season. They're getting to thinking about how badly they want to go run, and so they're kind of in training even at the moment.
Right.
You know, good high nutrition, lots of good meat. You know, we're keeping them healthy and ready to rock and roll. But when you start actually getting the lines and harnesses on them and out, I would say mid-August, whenever it cools down. I'd like to start August 1st. That's always my goal. But lots of times it doesn't start happening until middle of August.
When you say cool down, what is there a core temperature that you start at? You know, you always hear under 50 for these quick summer runs, you know, whether it be on the ATV or the cart or whatever people are using. What is your rule of thumb to get started?
You know, I tend to agree with that, under 50 degrees. You know, 40 would be better, unless you're running through water all the time. And so, you know, you're better off not even taking them out if it's too warm.
So when you start this fall training in order to prepare for the Iditarod, what do you normally start with? It's all over the board what folks are doing. What do you guys do at your place?
Well, right now I'm just pretty traditional. I started about 3 miles, and every few weeks I bump them up. And, you know, I think in the beginning what's most important is mental training is more important than physical. You can't really go far until you get snow. And so teaching them what you want them to do and building up a good rapport and a good bond with them, that's the most important thing in the beginning, you know, building up their trust.
Right. And by the time you're you know, setting up your team ready to go in early March, what are the longest runs you're doing at that time? Do you do a lot of multi-day trips, camping and that sort of thing, or do you just have kind of a set schedule that you do?
Well, you know, it really, when you have a small kennel, you've really got to key off of the individual dog. You know, you've really got to encourage him to do his best. And so I don't really have a set schedule every time. I try to key off of them and what they need. And but usually that means, you know, I get them up to 9 to 12 hours sometimes. And, you know, I try to spend a lot of hours on the trail and do lots of camping out in cold weather and tough conditions.
So let's get into this year's Iditarod. Again, we're talking to Ramey Smith on Mushing Radio. You can hear it live on 89.5 in Palmer and on podcast pretty much forever on mushingradio.com. It'll be available sometime later this evening or in the morning. Let's talk about this year's Iditarod. A heck of a finish coming in third. I know you really put the pedal to the metal there, and you ran one heck of a race this year. Let's talk a little bit about that. What can you share about the 2012 Iditarod?
Well, the 2012 Iditarod was very challenging right from the get-go. Even it really started in training. You know, the weather was tough. It was cold, you know, and, you know, I ran into a moose. So I wrecked my truck. You know, it was financially a struggle just to get to the starting line. And then once we got to the starting line, I felt like the team was ready to go. And then they caught the flu right off the bat. And, you know, it had been such a tough year. I don't know. I must have not have been up. The dogs were up to par, but I wasn't. And I fell asleep and fell off the sled. I don't even know what to think about that. But luckily, I recovered them within about 45 minutes, an hour. And I ran after them as quickly as I could, and they just pulled over, and somebody set the hook for them. And, you know, and it was soft, tough trail. But it was an uneventful run down through the gorge. We ran into a few trees, you know, smashed up our sled a few times. And but then they started to catch a flu with some of the main front end dogs. And so by the time I got to Katna, I was quite a ways behind, and I was going to have to play catch up. And I had a lot of dog care issues that I had to do and got to get some weight back on them and make them healthy and happy. And so it took me a few days to really get to that point.
So, just following it, you know, in the media and of course on the trackers and things, it looks like you were just pretty much playing leapfrog with all the mushers out there. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How that took place? That, you know, you're just passing guys one after another and moving up very quickly in the standings. How did that take part?
Well, you know, it takes part in training when they're puppies, really. You know, you got to work with them and baby them and to get them to really trust you so that when you get in tough conditions and storms and when you have to make long runs and catch up and go really fast, that they're like, okay, I know this guy, he'll take care of me. And then they just do what you ask. So we left Takotna, and I could see that I was going to have to really get after it. And so we did some long runs. I fed them real regular every couple hours, getting the high-calorie food into them. And by the time we hit Ruby, we'd started to gain on a few teams, and then it was like 40, 50 below on the river. That could have kind of put a cramp on my catch-up efforts because the cold sucks the calories out. And you kind of like have a gas tank, and I needed to use it for long runs, but they were having to use it for the cold weather to deal with the cold. And so there was a couple of runs I would have liked to have done longer and passed a few more people, but we had to play it careful and safe. And so we ran up the river through like 45 below temperatures with the wind blowing, and you know, you really needed the dog's trust for them to be able to handle that. And so by the time we got to the coast, we were to Unalakleet, we were doing pretty good.
So if you can, for you know, the mushers that are listening in the lower 48 that don't deal with temperatures like that, minus 45, how is that different for a dog team running in those temperatures versus, you know, 10, 0, minus 10, that sort of thing? You talked about sucking the gas out of them. How does that play into it? Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Well, you know, you got to wear coats, of course, and on the dogs. And you have to have booties. Sometimes you even have to double booty them, but most of the time not if they have furry feet. And what it does is cause you're going to have to feed a lot more fat. And, you know, you're going to have to feed them every hour to 2 hours, give them a little snack, and make sure that they eat well at the checkpoint to make sure that they have enough food in the tank if you're going to do some longer runs in the cold weather. And if you have wind, then that really also adds to the toughness of the whole event. And so if you're doing, you know, 9 to 12 hour runs and it's 45 below or 50, then you're going to have a tough dog mentally as well as one who can handle a harsh weather.
So as you were running there in those cold temperatures, were you dropping a lot of dogs at that point? How did the team finish up in terms of the number and you know, the toughness of them, I guess, by the time you hit Nome there?
You know, what's interesting there is, no, I wasn't dropping any dogs as much from the cold. In fact, the team was coming together, and I think that in Iditarod and a long race, dog care becomes so important. Because you want to have a fast overall time. You know, one fast leg doesn't matter particularly. What you want is a team effort. And so you want to pull the team together with your care, with your letting them know that you appreciate their individual efforts. And that's where it was massive focus on bringing the team together as a unit and making sure that they all had the meals that they needed, making sure they had the positive reinforcement that they needed. And so that's pretty much what that was all about.
If we could focus on that just a second, Ramey, when you talk about that positive reinforcement, a lot of people don't quite understand what the musher's role is in this whole thing. They pretty much think that we're standing on the back of the sled hollering commands and pretty much, you know, to feeding the dogs and that sort of thing. What is your routine? How are you encouraging these dogs down the trail? Do you talk to them? Do you whistle? Do you sing? Do you pet? What do you do?
Well, you know, the main thing is looking out for their needs. You know, at every checkpoint, you look at their feet, making sure that they aren't sore. If they are, you put in ointments, special ointments. If their wrists or joints are a little sore, you put on a liniment and you wrap it up carefully. If you see they're feeling a little emotional, you know, you pet them a little bit more. And but the main thing is that you watch them very carefully, and if you see one trying harder than the rest, you know, you stop the team, you go up there, you pet him and say, hey, you're doing a good job, you know, you're such a good dog. And when you go down the trail and they speed up, you go, you guys are such good puppy dogs, you know. And so it's all about nurturing what they love to do, and that's all.
So we have a few minutes left, about 5 minutes left, Ramey. I definitely want to get into anything you want to mention, but I have two more points I would like to make. It's been said that you're pretty much a marathoner out there yourself. You do a heck of a lot of running yourself off of the sled. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, you're out there, or I am, working as hard as I can. You know, it's probably a lot harder for me and humans in the cold temperatures than it is for the dogs. They don't really run good until it gets to be 20 below. And so that's pretty important, you know, for me or whoever the musher is, to be adapted to the cold and have lots of good quality gear, you know, down. And so, you know, you have to get in shape ahead of time, try to cut weight so that you're not too overweight, too heavy. You try to run up all the hills in training and get yourself prepared for it.
Right, right. My last question for you, Ramey, is we always ask you guys here on the show, especially you Iditarod guys, is if you could share one piece of advice to some up-and-coming mushers out there, whether they're out there running, you know, sprint races in their little town, or, you know, qualifying for that Iditarod in a couple years, or just a couple of mid-distance races, what can you tell those aspiring mushers out there, whether they're youngsters or, you know, the middle-aged type that have retired from their job and want to get involved with dog sledding?
I would say the first important thing is get the very best breeding you can get a hold of for the dogs, give them the very best nutrition you can afford, lots of meat, and I would say lots of positive reinforcement and time with the dogs, and you probably want to, you know, really focus on the individual and bringing out the best in the individual, and that'll pay off long term. When they get older, they'll still feel really happy about their job.
Very cool. Very
just
cool.
Make sure not to get too many.
So we have a couple minutes left. Anything else you want to mention here on the show? Again, like we said before we went on, it's really your show. Fire away if you have anything else you want to mention.
I just want to say that I really appreciate all the fans. You know, Iditarod and dog mushing couldn't exist without everybody who stands behind the sport. And I want to appreciate all the volunteers and everybody who put so much time and effort into it without getting paid a dime. And I just want to say that the state of Alaska is the most awesome state there is. And I want to thank my sponsor, Alaska Communication System, and my wife, Rebecca, and my daughter, Ava, and son, Daniel.
Very cool. You know, we talked to Alex Stein. He was my co-host during our Iditarod coverage this year, and we each picked winners for the 2013 Iditarod, and I picked you, so we're rooting for you here on Mushing Radio for 2013. Are you planning on running next year? Any surprises that you have in store for us this early in the season?
Yeah, we're going to go all the way. That's all I can tell you.
Very cool. Ramey Smith on Mushing Radio. It's much appreciated. Thank you very much for being on. And I'll definitely send over a link and things. I believe we have your email. If not, we'll get it off air, and we'll send this over so you can put it on Facebook or whatever you do, okay?
All right. Well, thank you, Robert.
Thank you. Ramey Smith, third place in 2012 Iditarod. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Until next time, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you then. Goodbye.